you can explore an exclusive collection of case law at Decisus Law Reports. Browse a comprehensive collection of nearly 14,000 reports of Irish legal judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisus.ie to find out more.
Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 73 of The Fifth Court, a podcast on legal affairs presented by myself, Peter Leonard, barrister and mediator.
And myself, Mark Totten, barrister and editor of Decisus Law Reports.
Mark, good to see you as always. And last week, we broadcast part one of our interview at the conference which had been held in Dublin Castle to mark the 100th anniversary of the Courts of Justice Act 1924. Our guests were Supreme Court Judge Gerard Hogan and Professor Diarmaid Ferriter from UCD. And I'm really looking forward to bringing our audience part two of that interview.
Absolutely. Fantastic conference and I think, well, great interview.
Okay, but first we're going to go to three cases that you've identified from the Decisus website. We start with an injunction granted against a winding up petition by a company director, citing the petition as an abuse of process. This is Cohesion Infestiecti Limited versus Salumi Grazing Limited and another.
Easy for you to say.
And that is a decision of Mr. Justice Sanfi in the High Court. Certainly was very easy to say, Mark.
Yeah, this is where a company director had issued a winding up petition against a business saying, and the application was to prevent him bringing the petition as an abusive process, saying that his claim of liquidated damages against the company due to the alleged unlawful termination of a license agreement was unsubstantiated and not a bona fide dispute, and therefore the injunction was brought. It's a bit unusual to bring court proceedings to prevent other court proceedings from being brought, but that's what happened in this case.
Okay, very interesting. Well, next to a landlord and tenant case, and this involved the frustration of a lease, the Court of Appeal dismissed an appeal from the High Court, and it affirmed the dismissal of a claim by a retail store for a declaration that its lease had been frustrated by the state-imposed closure of its premises. This is the case of Foot Locker Retail Ireland Limited versus Persee Nominees Limited, and it's a decision in the Court of Appeal by President Birmingham, George Birmingham.
Well, actually, the decision was, the judgment was given by Mr. Justice Barneville sitting in the Court of Appeal, but Mr. Justice Birmingham was presiding over the court. So the judgment is by David Barneville. This arises from the closure of a lot of retail stores as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. And what Foot Locker had to say here was that they shouldn't have to pay rent because they were frustrated by a third-party action from operating a retail store. And what the High Court had said and what the Court of Appeals affirmed was that there is no concept of temporary or partial frustration of a lease. If you want to claim frustration of a contract or of a lease, you need to say that it's completely frustrated. You can't kind of say, oh, well, we couldn't operate for a short time or whatever. And so in this case, they still had to pay the rent.
Next to a personal injuries case with a difference, and this was brought by a former pupil against the school he attended. The High Court found that the school was not required to have adult supervision at all times to prevent an assault by fellow pupils. This is the case of Kavanagh versus the Salesian of Don Bosco of Ireland. And it's a decision of Ms. Justice Denise Brett.
Yeah, so what happened here was that somebody, a 14-year-old boy, many years ago, it has to be said, was attending a school homework club. So this is one of these clubs that happens after school hours. And while, I think, during the first part of the homework club, he was there was no teacher present, there was no supervisor, and he was assaulted by a fellow pupil and kicked in the nether regions, resulting in permanent injury. So then, as an adult, he brought an action against the school, claiming that the school was negligent in its supervision. And the point that was made by the judge was that they simply couldn't, he couldn't establish that this was particularly foreseeable. You can't expect a teacher to be on hand all of the time when pupils are there. There was no particular reason to believe that the student who assaulted him was likely to be a danger to the other pupils. And so in the circumstances, they couldn't establish negligence on the part of the school.
Okay, very interesting decision. And I suppose there's a logic to that, really, isn't there? I mean, a whole school-wide population, can you watch everybody?
Yeah, I think on public policy grounds, you simply can't say that a school needs to have every single pupil watched by a teacher at all times.
Okay, and that was a decision from Ms. Justice Denise Brett. So back shortly with the second part of our interview with Professor Dermot Ferriter and Supreme Court Justice Gerard Hogan. Clio, the most recommended cloud-based legal software used by 150,000 lawyers worldwide. Want to streamline case management, automate tasks including your client intake process and billing while supported by a team of people 24/5? Visit clio.com/IE.
Silence in the Fifth Court.
Can I ask about another change that happened in the 1930s, which you're going to speak about this afternoon, Gerard? The increase in the number of Supreme Court judges from 3 to 5. Mm. What led to that change, and did it have a big effect on the courts thereafter?
I think it did. This is all in a subtle way all about the symbols of the state and the authority in the state. Kennedy understood that and wanted sort of an apex court like the Supreme Court that would be, you know, have a major role in its own way within the legal system as part of carving out the identity of the Irish legal system as different and distinct. And he had pressed for that in 1922 or 23-24, but as he was later to say, for reasons of economy, and that they were big, big considerations, as we know, in 1923-24, they kept to 3. Now, Kennedy was like a dog with a bone. He wouldn't let go. And the Supreme Court was actually then doing a lot of business in the late 20s, early 30s, hearing a lot of appeals. I mean, over 100 appeals with the 3 judges who also had to serve as the Court of Criminal Appeal. And, you know, there is the potential, you know, illness and conflicts of interest and so on. There was practical reasons why one needed 5. But there was also symbolic reasons why you needed 5, which was that it wasn't just 3 seemed like a kind of routine court of appeal that you would see in any common law jurisdiction. To have 5 was in its own way standing out as something different. Like the House of Lords then sat as 5, the Privy Council sat as 5. So to have 5 judges was a kind of another in its own way symbol of the importance of a Supreme Court at the top of an independent legal system that could stand on its own 2 feet.
And I mean, this happened just after the abolition of the appeal to the Privy Council and just before the adoption of the new constitution. Does it relate to those developments or is it coincidental?
A bit coincidental and, you know, a bit of both maybe, Mark. I mean, the Kennedy had been pressing for this for a long while. And, you know, he died suddenly in December 1936, just as the legislation had been promulgated.
Age just 57.
When the legislation had been promulgated, extending it from 3 to 5, but before the new judges were appointed. And then in 1937, again, remember, you know, there was this plan which was occupying, say, the first 4 months of 1937 for a plan for a constitutional court along the lines, really, of what, you know, the French have now, the Conseil Constitutionnel, with, you know, plans for the kind of the Count Corlins, Cahirlach of the Shannon, also to be part of this extended court. Ultimately, it was too radical. They scrapped it. But they did have the idea of an extended composition. So the Article 26, which is the closest holdover, if you like, from the plan for constitutional court, says that the Supreme Court, in an Article 26 reference and sent to Bill by the President, must sit as a court of at least 5 judges. And of course, legislation now says in any ordinary constitutional challenge, there has to be 5 judges.
And that brings us nicely to the 1937 Constitution, which is huge in the history of the last 100 years, Dermot. I mean, it's De Valera's great achievement. He has other achievements as well. I'm not saying that, but it is one of the great achievements. And what does that say? Put that into a historic context for us, please.
Well, it was partly about establishing the values that have been established since the foundation of the state, not just the values that have been established since Fianna Fáil came to power in 1932. So I wouldn't just see it as a Fianna Fáil creation in that sense, or De Valera's creation. It was very much about absorbing what had happened since 1922. And it was also something around which there were no guarantees that De Valera would succeed with this, because the referendum, the vote on the constitution was actually very close, which would suggest that this was something of a political risk.
And was there a clear opposition vote for that referendum?
Oh, there was, yeah. Well, you know, I mean...
And what was the kickback? What was the argument against?
Well, one of the most vociferous campaigns was led by another one of my predecessors, Mary Hayden, who was the first professor of modern Irish history in UCD. And Mary Hayden, really towards the end of her career, was appalled at the wording relating to women and their contribution to the state. And of course, we've heard an awful lot about that recently for obvious reasons, given the recent referendum. But, you know, that was the very public controversy associated with it. But there were other aspects. Some people were very concerned about the creation of an office of president, for example, that they were sowing the seeds of some future Nazi dictatorship. Some of these accusations were being flung on the dial.
Were Labour and Cumann na Gael opposed to the...
Well, I mean, they were picking apart different parts of it. Mm. I mean, there were aspects of the constitution that most people could cohere around or agree with. It's very interesting, obviously, and Gerard has looked at this extensively in relation to the correspondence around it and the people that De Valera was corresponding with and getting advice from. He didn't always take their advice, including John Charles McQuaid, when it came to the Articles on Religion, but he did lean on him very heavily when it came to Catholic social theory. And it's very much of its time, and it's very heavily influenced by Catholic social teaching, as was being enunciated by the popes of that era. But there's also a very serious committee that is assisting with this. So it's by no means a one-man constitution, but it's a very significant milestone. And De Valera was heading in a particular direction in the 1930s. He wanted to be able to say that Ireland was truly independent, and the constitution was a huge part of that. Of course, it didn't declare Ireland as a republic.
No.
Because there was still unfinished business. And again, going back to De Valera's sense of caution at times as well, he also knew, and I referred to this morning, that there could be an element of a straitjacket with regard to a republic as well. I mean, interestingly, he didn't insert neutrality as a constitutional issue that was to be a decision of the elected parliamentarians, which again is a reflection of his realism about both history and geography in relation to Ireland having options in the future. So, you know, he was cautious about certain things, but there's no doubt it was a landmark, but it could have gone badly wrong for him too.
Yes. And Gerard, yourself, I mean, just to comment on that, 1937 constitution replaces 1922 constitution. Business as usual, or were things very different as a result?
Both business as usual and things were very different. Business as usual in the sense that, as well as the Catholic social teaching to which Germans referred, it also drew on, if you like, the liberal Protestant tradition, you know, of the common law and legalism generally. I mean, one thing that I think is underappreciated about De Valera is that, I hope I'm allowed to say this, and I say this with a very, very much the smallest p you can imagine.
It's killing him.
He has, almost more than any other senior political figure we've ever had, he has a great sense of legal drafting, legal propriety, and so on. He has a real understanding, and he is a lawyer, constitutional lawyer, Monke. I mean, he has a real understanding of this in a way that, you know, few have matched. And I think that's a part of the contributor of the success of the constitution. The other, of course, business was not as usual because thanks in some ways to the Court of Appeal in May 1934 in the Cooney and Clinton case, the Free State Constitution could never get off the ground. It was shackled by three things: Cooney and Clinton and the implicit amendment of the Free State Constitution, the fact that it was tied to the treaty, and the fact that a civil war had been fought over it. So, De Valera, in a sense, was lucky, but he made his own luck. And he has one of the remarkable things, I think, about the Constitution is this, is that it has reinforced, it has kind of poured kind of cement into the concrete, you know, concrete cement of the state. And ironically, in a kind of a way, for a document that was supposed to herald and facilitate Irish unity, it has done the opposite, but not in the way that a lot of people talk about. You know, the fact that we originally banned divorce or the reference the Catholic Church, but in a very different way. It is that it has been enormously successful in creating the political and legal culture of the state. And it's all almost part of the state identity. And he was almost, from his perspective, almost too successful in that. In other words, the Constitution distinguishes between the nation and the state, but the effect of the Constitution was almost to conflate the two in the minds of most of the time, the majority of people living in this jurisdiction, between the nation and the state. They see the state and the nation as interchangeable. That wasn't originally De Valera's idea at all.
It's also a significant human rights document, you know, and we have to be very conscious of the time in which it was produced and what that tells us about the different priorities. And of course, there's the question then of how it was interpreted at various stages subsequently. But I remember listening to a leading feminist historian who was, you know, very critical of the articles relating to women in the Constitution. But she did make that assertion that this is a very significant human rights document, because she was very conscious, too, of how certain of the rights of women had been vindicated as a result of the way in which that Constitution was interpreted. So it becomes a very interesting, longer story.
Because we're talking today about the centenary of the courts, I mean, from 1937, I suppose, until 2014, when the Court of Appeal was instituted, I mean, there's fairly good continuity in terms of the institution, but in terms of what the Supreme Court does, they really, from the 1960s onwards, they take the Constitution and run with it, don't they? And the concept of judicial review really expands. I mean, do the institutions of the courts change radically between those two dates, between 37 and 2014?
Yeah, I think certainly the practice has changed a lot, because if we went back to the 40s and the 50s, you'd find the court sitting quite often, the amount of work was not spectacular. It would sit at the court at five for even routine cases. And some of those even routine cases could take, by modern standards, an inordinately long period of time to be argued. And that was partly because, say, in the 40s and the 50s, there was modern-day ideas of case management were simply unknown. You had the practice in the standard case in the 1940s, whereby, say, personal injuries appeal, whereby the junior counsel would stand up and read out the notice of appeal, sometimes read out the transcripts, and then you had arguments, but you didn't. You were sort of in pre-photocopier days where you had, you know, books and books and books were taken out and previous authorities were gone through laboriously, case after case after case. And so you could have ordinary, pretty ordinary appeals taking 7, 8, 9, 10 days. So sometimes some appeals lasted for 3 weeks. So that began to change with pressure of work. If you go to the 70s and 80s, you see the court sitting routinely as a court of three in a way that didn't happen in the 40s and 50s. And then again, with the expansion of the High Court and the growing population and growing litigation and so on, you had the expansion of the Supreme Court beyond the original 5-6, first in 1995. And now, you know, it's now about 10 judges, 9, 10 facility for 9 or 10 judges on the Supreme Court, you know, you now have kind of active case management, time limits, what's supposed to be quiet time for counsel. Better not comment too much on that. Whereby counsel are given 10, 15, 20 minutes to open the case before the court, before any of us come in and devour them with questions. You know, so there's been a big change in practice as well as that over that period. But also in terms of the type of work the court has done, it's very different from the 30s and 40s.
Dermot, can I bring you in there? We're talking about sort of post-1937 and the impact of the Supreme Court. And as a social historian, as a historian of Ireland and social change in Ireland, the roles played by the Supreme Court in the 60s and 70s, we just celebrated recently the 50th anniversary of the famous McGee case.
But the McGee case,
So the impact of the courts in terms of social change in Irish history.
But there's great social history wrapped around some of those landmark decisions. And the McGee case has been on my mind recently, partly because at the heart of it all is a great love story, a great human story. Seamus McGee only died a few weeks ago. And they were mad about each other. And they were formidable characters, both of them. And, you know, Mary McGee had a very serious medical condition, toxemia of pregnancy. And it illuminated a broader theme about women having multiple pregnancies and the consequences for their health. And, the broader social backdrop there is about a debate on contraception in the 60s and the 70s that can't be contained anymore. And it's not just about morality anymore. It's about health. And there's quite a decisive shift there. So this case is at the heart of that. And of course, it went to the High Court first and then the Supreme Court. And the issue then of privacy, marital privacy, and the violation of that privacy, and what that represented in relation to Irish history. You know, when you looked at, you know, we were talking this morning about 1924 and the very strict policing of people's private lives and what was regarded as public morality.
The famous Piss case.
I mean, there's an ethos around all that which is unravelling to a degree. And the same was true in, you know, relation to the right of women to be called automatic jury services.
Of course, in the Maureen De Burke case, yes. But the Supreme Court being an engine for social change, I mean, not politics.
But it's about unenumerated rights, I suppose.
Doing their thing and having an impact.
Yeah, having an impact. And also, I suppose, this connected debate of what is this document? What is this constitution? It cannot be frozen in time. It needs to be looked at in different ways at different stages in responses to societal demands. And I mean, that can be a very complicated area. And you're not going to generate unanimity of legal opinion around those questions. But you can see certainly a decisive shift in relation to a court that is prepared to see itself as having a role in all that. And some of the decisions that are made, including most obviously around the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 1935, they have profound consequences for so many people over an extended period.
I have to let you comment on the May McGee case, Gerard. I know you believe it's one of the high points in terms of Supreme Court judicial decision making.
Yeah, it was certainly a remarkable case. I mean, over and above the whole issue of contraception and the role of women and role of women in society and privacy and so on, I mean, it was a remarkable case in terms of it actually dominated the discourse, the social discourse in the state for 5, 6, 7, 8 years thereafter. And, you know, people didn't forget that. So and it was also at a time when, I mean, to put this also in perspective, there's been about over 100 instances of declarations of unconstitutionality. If you do final orders of court in the High Court, High Court, Court of Appeal and Supreme Court. But the McGee case in 1973 was only about the 11th or 12th time it had ever happened. So, I mean, I've often said it's a bit like, in some ways, an Irish Brown and Board of Education, in the sense that it set forth a social revolution. I mean, that was the desegregation case in the United States. It set forth a social revolution, the consequences of which, both legally and politically, are being still felt today.
Okay, Mark, are we running out of time?
I think we're close to our time.
We wanted to talk about the EU and the impact that has had, because obviously that's very, very significant, but maybe we don't have time. Just to sum up, we're here to commemorate the 1924 Act. You know, success or failure, Gerard, is it too early to tell? What do you think?
Well, I'd have to recuse myself on this, I suppose. But yes, I think really a great success. And it was such a success that we take it for granted. Obviously, in retrospect, there's things that perhaps should have been done. But given the fraught state of the country and really the huge destabilization of not only ending 700-800 years of one regime, but then the huge trauma of the Civil War, to lay the foundations in that way with the 1924 Act was a huge
thing. Okay, and Dermot, your own views 100 years on?
Yeah, I would connect it to that broader theme of recovery and trying to generate a consensus around certain key pillars in Irish society. That was true of policing as well, when we consider the history of An Garda Síochána, the Síochána, and the difficulties around establishing an unarmed, largely unarmed police force in a very divided community. And in the long run, despite various problems, it broadly worked in the sense that even today, if you were to ask people about the institutions that they trust the most, some of the institutions that were generated in this decade are those institutions today that people still have a very high regard for. And that has to be regarded as a very significant achievement in state building. But they were never, of course, without complication or controversy.
Yes.
And do you think looking at the fraught background you're talking about, I mean, the speed at which the new court system took hold appears to have achieved the respect of all sections of society and continue to...
Yeah, it did happen relatively quickly. I mean, there are always going to be those who wouldn't recognise the legitimacy of these institutions. But broadly speaking, that did happen quickly. And again, it's related to that other issue we've raised about the relatively speedy recovery from civil war. But you have to have people in place who are making these new initiatives a priority. And they're not necessarily a matter of intense, broad public discourse. You know, I mean, this is highly specialized in all sorts of ways, which is why today is great, you know, in that, you know, you're talking about this being a centenary that's not just relevant to the legal profession. This is a centenary that's relevant to us all. And it makes us think about coming out of that decade of revolution and what the options are there. And some people, as we've already underlined, opt for a very cautious approach. But you can, and I think that's reflected maybe in Kennedy, you can mix sometimes caution with a determination to be radical in certain areas. That combination could work quite well in terms of establishing those new institutions.
Okay, well, we have to say this has been absolutely fantastic. It's been a wonderful discussion. We're going to broadcast it, folks, so it'll be out in the next couple of weeks as a Fifth Court podcast, probably two episodes. So can I say a huge thank you to Mr. Justice Gerard Hogan and to Professor Diarmaid Ferriter for being our guests on the Fifth Court today.
The Fifth Court will adjourn until next week.
So that's all from this edition of the Fifth Court. We hope you have enjoyed it. Thank you to our guests, Mr. Justice Gerard Hogan and Professor Diarmaid Ferriter, for that wonderful interview. We had to put it over two episodes. It was so good, Mark.
I think it's fantastic, yeah.
It was really good, and we're delighted with it, and I think we got a great response to part one. People hopefully will enjoy part two as well. Before we go, I would like to say a big thank you to our producer, Cunnel O'Moroyne, and to Peter Rice of the Dublin South Podcast Studios for their wonderful work in recording this show. So from me, Peter Leonard.
Myself, Mark Tottenham.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon in the Fifth Court.
Never miss a vital Irish legal judgment. Check out Decisis Law Reports, where you'll find a fully indexed collection of all Irish judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisis.ie to find out more.